Tim Davis, thank you very much indeed for speaking to UK Column. Tim is a 20-year veteran of the Royal Air Force, having flown fast jets and trained other servicemen on such for that period of time. I'm sure he can come on and talk a little bit about that. But Tim, what I'd like to start with is a reference to the constant flow of information we're getting from government about how the United Kingdom is helping Ukraine to, whether it's supply equipment or arms or ammunition. But in this case, most recently, the training of 10 pilots who are said to have completed basic training and some language training. And I think really to put that in context for the UK Column audience, how significant is the training, the basic training of 10 pilots who may or may not go on to fly F-16? And can you try and set that within the context of a training year within the United Kingdom on those sorts of platforms, as in fast jet, but also thinking about the Ukrainians and the Russians?
Yeah, there's a lot in that. I'm not an expert, Charles, but it's lovely to come and chat to you about it. So I taught on what's called phase four fast jet flying training here. So there are four phases in effect. Is the clues in the name there, isn't it, really? So what the Ukrainians have done is they've been given what's called elementary, not basic necessarily, because if they're going to go into basic, they'll be flying a different aircraft, of which we have 10. That's called the T-6 Texan II. And I know that because I brought them all into service myself when I was a requirements manager. So this is the Hawk T2. Obviously, we can't fly them on this. It's got engine issues at the moment. We've got 28 of those, of which probably five or six are serviceable now, whilst they sort the engines. There's no capacity. There's no capacity, full stop. So they did something called elementary, which is on the Prefect aircraft, which is the big propeller at the front. But the actual cockpit layout is quite advanced. And we have 23 of those. And I also brought those aircraft into the service back in 2018 before I left. It's a much slower aircraft. It flies about 120 to 150 knots. The Hawk here flew around about 500 miles an hour, 450 knots, that kind of thing. So what they've done is they've had an introduction to Royal Air Force fast jet training, but the very basic side of it, if that makes sense, the very elementary side of it. And it will give them enough to go on to an intermediate trainer, but I believe they're all now going to go on to Alpha Jet out in France, which is very similar to the Hawk here. So it's almost like they're missing a stage. And I understand why they can do that, because the Prefect, it can be quite a fast aircraft. You can sort of bridge Prefect into Hawk or into Alpha Jet. We don't do it in the Royal Air Force because of the complexities. It needs a lot of care. They're probably not going to get that care. And there's a language barrier. I'm a guy that would say that you're very unlikely to see F-16 in Ukraine without a whole world of support that we're probably not going to give. And I think this is a kind of stalling tactic where we pretend we're offering all this kind of stuff to Ukraine. It's going to come. It's all these packages are going to happen. Norwegians are going to give you their older aircraft because they want to get back into some kind of future American deal for F-35 or whatever. But I think it's unlikely. The training's complex. I don't think it's been comprehensive. We can't possibly make it comprehensive unless we fly them on the Hawk here, which we've got no capacity to do. So it is what it is. I think it's a bit of a smoke screen, to be fair.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the impression that people have got. But and so just on the numbers, I mean, if given best case scenario and the support that you describe was available and things ran to plan, first of all, how long would it take to have an operational capability from those 10 pilots? But also, how significant in the wider scheme of things is 10 pilots?
It's not significant at all. Also, you don't have a sustaining training capability as well. So that's another thing. You've got 10 pilots, you're going to put an F-16, presumably to be frontline. There's no way of regenerating that capability in-house. You'd need and this is, I'll tell you what the funny thing is here, Charles, to be fair. And we're all hiding it. Of course, we're all hiding it with Macron sending French troops out there and that kind of stuff. It's almost not even a proxy war anymore. Do you know what I mean? It's a full-on NATO versus Russian war. I mean, I remember, I don't want to get into detail here because you're not asking me these questions. That's absolutely fine. But of course, when Russia asked if they could join NATO, they were told, yes, you could. And then a few months later, they were told, no, you can't. You know, so it's obvious that NATO is an anti-Russian pact. That's fine. We're not talking about that. But the thing about it is, of course, is that they will have no inherent indigenous capability to continue training their own pilots. F-16 is a complicated airplane. So here's the thing. So we can spin this now. So if I trained a guy into this, I train people on my virtual flight school, and they're very capable, of course. But then if I was going to put them in a real airplane, I need to put them in real jets. I need to give them that real training. So simulated versus real training. Someone coming through this airplane here in the Royal Air Force is probably taking about, if we do it properly, it should take 3.5 years. It's never been done. Even when I went through, I took about four and a bit. Now it's about 7 because of the holes they've got to do in between, because we just, backlogged on courses. The Ukrainians wouldn't be any different. And of course, British pilots don't have that language problem that Ukrainians have. And it is a language problem still. I've trained Qataris, Saudis, I've trained Indian pilots, I've trained all sorts. Language is a huge issue when you get into a cockpit like this, which is loud, it's hot, there's a lot of vibration. You need to be able to hear what's going on, understand the language. So we've got to put someone, even when they finish on this course here, they're still going to go on to this aircraft here, like the Tornado, which we don't fly anymore, so Typhoon F-35. That's going to take you a year, possibly 6 months to a year, to train up on that. And then you're not combat ready, you're limited combat ready. No one's going to throw you into a fight, you're going to get killed. So we still need to train you up. We still need another 6 months, maybe even more than that, where you then progress through onto different leadership aspects, where then you can be taken into some kind of combat zone. So it's not as if we know the reason the F-16s aren't in theater is they're going to get shot down. Full stop. There's no two ways about it. I was the electronic warfare instructor, so I'm very familiar with the surface-to-air missile strategies that the Russians use. I don't speak out of turn about it, of course, but you could read about it on any kind of decent website now. They are masters at ground-based air defense. That's why we don't have the permissive air environment over there. You see the Ukraine aircraft flying at treetop height. Of course they are. If they flew any higher, they're going to get shot down. This is why we have Royal Air Force aircraft over the Black Sea, targeting into Ukraine and telling the Russians, sorry, telling the Ukrainians where everything is, where all the Russian stuff is. We have that there because they can't be over Ukraine. The RAF cannot be over. They'd be shot down. They're almost shot down over the Black Sea, remember, weren't they? In the aircraft they were using there. So it's a bit of a ploy. It's a bit of a, you can imagine, this coalition is basically saying, look, we're going to make it happen, but we're just kind of dragging it along a little bit. It probably means we can print more airplanes. American jobs always popular, of course, isn't it? You know how defense works. People's stock goes up, of course. Let's hold it long enough so we can all cash in on the deaths of young men, of course, on both sides. But I can't see it happening, to be fair. I hate to be that guy. I can't see it happening. And if you listen, I was listening to Richard Sheriff, General Richard Sheriff, recently at Oxford Union, speaking against George Galloway. Absolute warmonger. There's no two ways about it. There's absolutely, when you listen to him, you listen to Richard Sheriff, and then you go and listen to Tobias Elwood and these kind of people, you're thinking you're wanting to send young men to their deaths for no reason. This thing will end in a stalemate. We know it will. It's going to be, oh, let's stop here, shall we? Oh, that's the same thing we had about 2 years ago, was it, where we'd lost a third of Ukraine? Yeah, absolutely. So what did we do as 2 years ago? Oh, because Johnson went over there January last year and he kept you fighting because he wanted to increase all the defense stocks so we can get rid of our arms. I mean, the whole thing's, it's a Smedley Butler, isn't it? War is a racket thing, but it's so transparent now. It's kind of brutal, really. So in short, I don't see it happening. 10 pilots isn't enough. We couldn't train anymore anyway. We haven't got the capability to train our own right now. So it's a bit of a sad state of affairs, Charles.
That was actually going to be one of the things I was going to ask you about. What, in having had to have given space to train 10 pilots, albeit in an elementary capacity, what will the knock-on effect have been for Navy or Air Force pilots here?
Yeah, exactly. So they're not training them. If you're training Ukrainians, you're not training British. That's the end. And the funny thing is, when I was training here, we used to get messages in saying, we've got a, what did we do? We sold some Typhoons to Saudi Arabia, I think it was. And on the back end of that deal, no, it was Qatar. That's right. We sold Typhoons to Qatar. On the back end of the deal, we gave them, I think it was 5 or 6 Hawk T2s, which they didn't really want. You can't really do much with 6 of these airplanes because you're going to have some maintenance the whole time and you need a bigger fleet. They've got a bigger fleet now, but at the time they didn't. And then we were told in about 3 weeks' time, there's a bunch of Qataris coming over to start training. And we said, well, hang on, no one's talked to us about this. We've got British guys training. We also had some other countries, but we've got British guys training. So we've got to stop those British guys training and we've got to train the Qataris, all because the government has said, we've made a promise to Qatar to train some of their pilots. That's all well and good, but no one's spoken to us. And even if they had spoken to us, it wouldn't have mattered. We would have said, don't do it just yet. We've got British guys going through. And they would have said, well, we made a promise. There's a disconnect. There always will be. And it's quite harmful, really, because the seniors in the service will always go along with it because they want the knighthoods and they want the lords and whatever is going to get afterwards. They're going to BAE Systems as the higher ups. I'm not cynical about that because a lot of people my age obviously want exactly the same thing. However, I never did. I wanted to just get guys through the flying training system to make this country more secure. And I didn't want to disrupt their training. So if you have a Ukrainian training, you don't have a British pilot training. And if you don't have that British pilot training, this is the thing that people forget. You don't have that British pilot going onto the front line. What you don't have then is another person coming back into the training pipeline as an instructor. So you have this double whammy now. That means you haven't got any instructors now to train the pilots you don't ha yet have and you're going to have. So it impacts on two levels. And that's why when flying training breaks, it doesn't break a little bit, it breaks a lot very quickly. But this is what we keep telling people. Don't interrupt flying training. Keep flying training. Be in the front line. Do something with the front line. Mess around with the front line jets. That's absolutely fine. But you've got to keep the output from flying training into the front line. If you stop that, you've got no one coming back to be instructors. And now you have this huge crash. And that's what we're seeing at the moment all across what we call the United Kingdom military flying training system. In different bits and pieces, we're seeing fragmented failures. But it's just how it is.
So with that in mind, what's your assessment of the overall capability, the UK's capability at the minute and over the next sort of 5, 7 years?
It's funny, as in a war fighting capability, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'd obviously go, wouldn't we? Union flags on our back, and we'd go and we do the best we could. But you know, if you look at the, I think the Air Force is 33,500, something like that now. Anyway, if you look at Tesco's, it's 330,000. I mean, it's a funny thing when we place so much importance in such a small amount of people. And I've said this recently. I think Diamond's out in the HMS Diamond's out, isn't she? Fighting Houthi rebels, one of the only type 45s that we really have that can actually do it. And that's not sustainable in any shape or form. I mean, it doesn't take much to impact one of these ships where you lose that capability. I mean, I was a naval officer for 5 years before I transferred. You just don't have that ship there. It's not as if you can replace it. And I say this again with the aircraft, the amount of aircraft we have, they're so expensive now. We don't have combat mass. We have a very technical, small amount of aircraft. I mean, this is why. I mean, when we talk about appeasing, people talk about appeasing Hitler and appeasing Putin and all this kind of thing. We appeased Hitler because he weren't ready to fight a war back in 1938. That's the whole point. And when I'm saying, no, we need to appease Hitler a little bit, sorry, appease Putin a little bit here, there's many, many reasons for that. But we don't have the combat strength in any capability to deal with what Russia would present and is presenting now, and we are seeing, of course. So, you know, it's on multiple levels. It's not just a here are our tanks, here are your tanks, we're going to go to war. There's a lot of cyber now. There's a lot of things that we don't see and we're not really that aware of. Drones weren't something that people talked about until Ukraine really happened, although that technology was there. The efficacy was still in doubt, but of course now it's proving that it's worth something. So there's lots of capabilities, especially in the electronic magnetic spectrum, EW, electronic warfare, that we may well be a little more capable of. But when it comes down to fighting forces, I noticed the army the other day was going back in trench warfare. The thing is, we always lag as well. That's another thing. The thing about the military that I realized, having spent 20 years there, is we were reactive to a lot of things. So it wasn't, there was no real time for innovation as such. That tended to come out of the boffins in London, but there wasn't anything, it was all done in-house on squadrons. And the problem with being in the military is you have no time to think of anything other than what you're doing. So if I spoke to any of my guys still flying now about Russia, they would have the 180 view on me, because all I do is read podcasts, I listen to things, you know what I mean? Very experienced people that know more about it than me, international relations scholars, guys like yourself, whatever, you know, have a great chat. When you're in the military, you don't have any capability whatsoever to do that. There's no time, no time whatsoever. You're very good at doing that and very good at doing that, but your opinion would be Russia bad, America good. And that's almost like a good thing, Charles, to have that, because you don't want people questioning things in the military. This is why I argue against diversity in the military. I'm like, hang on a second, you want everyone thinking the same, you know what I mean? Let's not start mixing up some ideas. That's the wrong place for it. But that's so why I push against that. But that's not the reason I push against it, many other reasons. But I just think that you don't really have it thought through at all. You don't know what you're doing. There's no end game in sight. There's no conclusion. There's no. I was chatting to a guy the other day that's a very arrogant man who is in intelligence, telling me that he's got it all worked out, his plan. I said, "What is the end game for this?" He said, "Oh, it's all a bit, you know, hush hush." And I said, "Do you really know what it is? Like, have you got an end game? Is it really breaking up Russia into 15 independent? I mean, is that what you're really trying to do? And if so, how do you control that, by the way? Because if Putin's not there, you're going to get something a lot worse, and you're going to get 15 of these a lot worse people. You know what I mean? It's not, but of course, you know. So I don't think we know. I don't think we have the capability. Oh my God, as a country, we don't. Absolutely not. We rely on America. We rely on everyone else. And if you look at what's going to happen to France, When France goes in, you will see French deaths. There's no two ways about it. This is all to do with losing control of the African colonies. It's to do with the uranium they're trying to get out of, well, they can't get out of now, and they're trying to feed their nuclear. You know more about this than me, of course. About 63% of France is nuclear, or something ludicrous like that. So it's a loss of control, and they're going in there now because the Russians are taking over these African colonies. And also, what happens when France gets attacked, which will happen? Is that then a justification for NATO to go in? Because something's got to justify it. Because right now we're not justified, Charles. Oh, that's the thing. There is no justification. So we're looking for something. So in short, no, of course, no, we're not. We haven't got any capability whatsoever at the moment, I don't think, really, to work out how this thing ends.
Yeah. No, I mean that provocation is, I think, exactly what people have been concerned about since this started. I mean, it really is. Drones, you mentioned, and I wanted to ask you about that. Now, tell me how much has the drone capability changed, and indeed the countermeasures to any drone capability, and how does it affect the overall airspace?
Okay, I'm not an expert on drones. Literally, what I've read. That's all. When I was flying, I didn't have any connection with drones whatsoever. I don't want you speaking to your people pretending I'm a drone expert. You get a lot of people doing that. Well, I think you're fine with drones. I've got one because I use it to look at the roof of my house and stuff. All the tiles are cracking, you know what I mean? And then I send the report to a guy who comes and charges me lots of money to fix it. Insofar as drones, I did fly with one guy actually, a very clever man, came through MIT, and he said he was still the worst person at MIT. That's how clever this guy was. He was absolutely phenomenal. F-16 pilot on exchange with us. And he went back, and when he left us, he was training with us on this air, teaching with me as an instructor. Went back to America. He was offered the command of an F-16 squadron, and he turned it down to go into drones. He said, "No, the future is not these airplanes. The future is drones." This was going back now, Charles. It must have been going back to 2014, 2015. That guy knew then that drones were the future, and all of us laughed at him. Said, "Go and fly F-16s again. It'd be amazing." No. I know where the future is. And he's on them now. I haven't spoken to him since, but he's obviously, you know, this is all his kind of work. It has rapidly changed the battlefield. There's no two ways about it. If you start looking at what they're doing to two main battle tanks for a, you know, a Mavic Pro or whatever it is with a whole world of explosions, I mean, it's completely changed it. And this is where it comes down now to appreciating the electromagnetic spectrum and how, if we can control all these waves going through the air, electronic warfare, if we can control them, if we can jam them, if we can deny that permissive environment to the enemy, if we can get inside their OODA loop, things like this. Then obviously we stand a chance of winning. But I feel personally, like I have done for ever since this thing started, that we are on the back foot. We never really, it's not that we didn't expect it as such. I think we did. I just don't think that we realized that I didn't honestly believe that we were going to be naive enough. Well, I say we because I don't include myself in this. Our politicians were going to be naive enough to think that they stood a chance of winning a conventional war with Russia on the Russian border. I don't know why anyone would have thought that. And it's not even the amount of sacrificial elements of, it's not even that. It's the lack of the end state. It's this hybrid conflict. It's these drones, as you say. It's the trench warfare. It's the fact Russia's got 5 kilometers of depth of trenches, which is dug with machinery. It did it within the first 2 months of the war. It knew what was happening. And we're expected to take that ground back. No, it was never. Once that happened, once the civil war from 2014 carried on, you know, and Russia went, hang on a second, if you stop now, we'll have it. It was going to stop in June, in January 23, wasn't it? If you remember, Putin got together and he said, let's have a chat. You know, we don't want, we just want a buffer. We don't want you to be sort of in neutral state. And it didn't. I think, I don't, yeah, I don't, I think I think drones are one of the many aspects, not just that. I think drones are, there's many, many things in this that we didn't really see and we can't really counter. And I don't think we really have the appetite for it if you look at, you know, the state of British politics at the moment.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think unrealistic is probably the word that springs to mind every time Grant Shapps opens his mouth.
Oh.
So that will resonate, I think, with the audience.
Yeah.
Just as a fun, you know, this is all part of a much bigger picture, which I think is completely misreported by politicians and indeed the mainstream media. So I hope this doesn't sound like too rudimentary a question, but I think it would be such useful context. You just describe the significance of the airspace, or rather control of the air in the overall battle picture, and how that manifests in this day and age.
What are you saying? Can I?
Well, no, I mean just an overall description of control of the air. I mean, how does it work? How does that fit with land and sea? how significant is it, in its entirety? I mean, I suppose specifically with reference to what's going on in Russia and Ukraine at the moment, but I think for a lot of people, they hear, we hear stories about pilots being trained, we hear stories about new drones being bought. I mean, okay, we've discussed drones, but I think the thing that will never come across from Westminster or its immediate orbit is what any of this really means.
Well, how many military men do you ever have now within that political sphere?
Yeah,
I'm not
exactly.
saying you should. I'm just saying it's useful to have. Control of the air. Well, it's everything, isn't it? One of the things about the British Army at the moment is they haven't fought a battle in the last, well, going back to what the Falklands now, where they haven't had control of the air. So they haven't experienced enemy aircraft coming in and targeting them at all. So the relationship between air and the army really was one that was a bit strange because the army had never seen the opposite. The army had always had the Royal Air Force over the top, or the United States Air Force, or the Coalition Air Force. So it never felt that when it was digging in or anything that anyone was going to put an SU-25 over the top and be rocketing them whilst they were trying to do their operations. It never had it. It didn't have any experience of it. And until you have that experience of it, you fail to appreciate the importance of control of the air. I'm not saying it's a panacea. I'm saying it's one of many aspects. You need the control of the intelligence. The first thing that happened in the Gulf War, I think this was 91, was the night before the big push, all the tornadoes went and everything else. All the commanders of the surface-to-air missile batteries and the AAA, so the anti-aircraft batteries, they had a phone call go into them. So they picked up their mobile phones, and on the end of it was someone from the CIA, MI6, and they said, "We know where your kids go to school." They knew the guy's name. "We know you command this battery. We know your kids go to school. We know the name of your kids. We know where your wife goes to work. If you go to work tomorrow, mate, if you go to work tomorrow in the morning, we're going to kill your kids. We're going to kill your wife. We're going to come and find you. We're going to kill you as well." And then the phone went dead. So something like 75% of those commanders didn't turn up for work in the morning. And therefore, we were able to go in, we're able to target those surface-to-air missile systems. And this is what I mean. It's not just a kinetic war of dropping bomb on head. It's not just about that. A lot of it is that control, that intelligence, that how do we get rid of these senior people? How can we do? Do we know who these people are? So control of the air, as important as it might be, isn't something we have right now. It's something that Russia is very good at because we went down the fighter route. This is actually a bomber, but there was a fighter variant as well. Let's have fighters. Russia went, "Well, we're going to have some fighters, but we're also going to mainly have surface-to-air missile systems so we can saturate the airspace. So anything coming into it, we can target and shoot that down." That's something Russia did very well. It's something that we've really got a problem with because it's really hard to target those things with anything other than the special forces. So we need to have special forces on the ground. Even when you do a special force on the ground, you still have military guys protecting those sites because they're so important, and the mobile as well. We don't always know where they are. This is one of the big problems that we've got at the moment. We can't just put aircraft in to use HARMAR missiles against the radars that we don't really know where they are. We've got to have other aircraft up there to triangulate positions, to have a lowdown, a battle picture, an electronic warfare picture of where the emissions are coming out of. We can't build that picture necessarily unless we have aircraft in there to build the picture and then other assets to target. So the coalition needs to be very big. This is why in Iraq it was a very big coalition that went in there. We had to saturate the airspace first. We had to make sure we had control of it. And then we can fight the ground battle. You do not want to be fighting a ground battle when you don't have control of the air. It's a ridiculous thing to do. Everyone's going to saturate. Everyone is going to target you. You've got tanks, Challenger tanks rolling across, being whacked by SU-25s and all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's hopeless if you don't have control of the air. And we don't have control of the air. And now the other control that we don't have, of course, necessarily, is these drones that are independently targeting, although very local, of course. The drones tend to be within a couple of kilometers of the operator. So that is a bit different. So yeah, it's very important. And we don't really have it. In order to have it, this is what I mean. It's you can't just put some F-16s in Ukraine. They need to be fully supported with tankers, with airborne warning and control units. With electronic warfare platforms to tell them where these surface-to-air missile systems are. And what happens when they get shot down? It's like when the Leopard 2 tanks get hit. It's like when the Challengers get hit. Who wants to buy a Challenger or a Leopard 2 when you know it can get taken out by a drone? Do you want to buy an F-16 when you know it can get shot down over Ukraine? I mean, are you really going to buy an F-16? Are we going to give more electronic warfare jamming capability as well? That's an entirely secret as well. We don't want to hand that stuff over. What happens if the Russians get it? There's no way we can go and get it back. If we have a ground picture and an air picture built together and we lose an aircraft, we can saturate that. We can bomb our own aircraft. We can get those things back. We can get the jammers back. We can get the munitions back. If we give them to Ukrainians, we can't. I think they found some Starstreak missiles, shoulder-launched missiles in Colombia. The weapons we put into Ukraine are all over the world now. We knew it was going to happen, of course, because the money's gone as well, isn't it? So, yeah, the command and control of the air picture is incredibly important. I can't see how we're going to build it up without an absolute a commitment from NATO to go in, which I think I don't know what they are. I don't know. I'm so despondent of it at the moment, Charles, to be fair. And I think a lot of us are. I get attacked by a load of my ex-colleagues all the time. And all I say is, look, have you read this book? Have you spoken to this guy? Have you chatted to this guy? Listen to this. This they none of it. They've listened to none of it. And I think that's what makes it inherently dangerous. Like almost they have too little knowledge. They think, well, they haven't thought. This is the danger that there is no thinking going on. And it almost makes it more dangerous than it's like Finland joining NATO. It's more dangerous to do that than it was to remain neutral, which is, but no, they can't see it. So I don't know. Maybe you've got an answer, Charles. Maybe your readers here have got an answer.
I'll certainly be much better informed now. Tim Davis, thank you very much indeed.